This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Today's macroeconomic word of the day is full employment. Give a definition, please, and then use it in a sentence. For example, with today's jobs report, are we at full employment? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal, the 5th of February today, Friday, but not just any Friday, you know. Great, by the way, to have you with us, as always, everybody. This happens to be the third Friday after the conclusion of the reference week, which in labor market speak means it's jobs day. The numbers you've heard already, 151,000 new names on payrolls last month. Not terrible, but yeah, it could have been better. Also, the unemployment rate fell to a quite nifty 4.9%. That number is the lowest we've seen since February of 2008. In other words, it's been a good long while, and it is going to start nudging the macroeconomic conversation, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman tells us, toward a very interesting place.
Now, full employment does not mean that every single person who wants a job has one. There's always churn, people switching jobs, unskilled workers who can't find anything. But on balance, says Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, full employment means
people who have the skills and want to work are able to get a job.
So let's go where that equation starts, to a place where people look for jobs, the unemployment office, this one in Oregon. Lolita Thomas is age 50 sort of something. She didn't want to get too specific.
I'm working part-time right now. I am looking for various jobs. Can I occupy my need? I need some money.
Economist Aparna Mathur at the American Enterprise Institute says there's a big block of people like Thomas that the job market's not matching with employers.
We know that there are about 6 million people who are still saying, well, we are involuntary part-time employed. We would prefer to have full-time jobs, but we're just not finding them.
Mathur says we still have too many long-term unemployed, teens and minorities unemployed, millions more who are discouraged and have stopped looking. All signs to her that this 4.9% unemployment economy isn't close to full employment yet.
What we really want is all these people who are looking for jobs to find jobs, and that will really start showing up in the wage data.
Because at full employment, employers should have to sweeten the pot, offer better pay and benefits to attract and retain the workers they need. And the last time we had that good an economy was the end of the 90s economic boom when unemployment fell below 4%. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, we're going to pick up right where Mitchell left off. 4 minutes of live radio in which to wrap up the week that was, might be four and a half. I don't know. Lee Gallagher is at Fortune Magazine. Sudeep Reddy is at the Wall Street Journal. Hey, everybody.
Hey,
Kai. Hi.
So, Lee, let me start with you and literally the thing Mitchell left off with, which was this idea of rising wages. We saw in this report today, I think it was the second or third month in a row of increasing wages. Has to be a good sign.
It is a good sign. It is a good sign. It's an important good sign. But the other factors that Mitchell mentioned, the part-time workers who want to work full-time, the participation rate,
those remained
unchanged this time. It's important to note that one jobs report does not a trend make. We've had several strong reports. But in terms of, you know, really looking into those metrics in particular, it's not so great on that side. And wages, you know, why aren't we seeing those other things go up?
Well, Sudeep, why aren't we seeing those other things go up?
We are seeing some wage growth, and that we should give ourselves a little bit of credit for that. And especially when you adjust for inflation, partly because of really cheap gas prices, inflation-adjusted wages are looking far better than a lot of people give it credit for. It's obviously far from satisfying for most Americans. We've had years where we saw market markets go on a tear, and we thought the wage growth is pitiful. Now we've got markets being very nervous, and we knew that the roles would reverse, but it's just not the scale of reward people were looking for in terms of wage growth, in terms of the availability of jobs out there, and in terms of the opportunities to rise up the job ladder.
Lee, what do you think, though, of the idea that, you know, maybe this is as good as it gets, and it's going to be a long while before wages keep pace with the other tightening in the labor market?
I think that's a scary thought, and that sort of goes in line with this sort of slow, steady recovery we've seen. And, you know, the other thing that's sort of scary, and I'm usually an optimist on the jobs front, but the other thing that's kind of scary is jobs are really a lagging indicator. So if the market's going crazy now and all these other metrics are not great right now, there's a laundry list of them, does that mean that we're going to see more pain in jobs? I mean, I would think and hope not, but it begs a question.
All right. So Sudeep, let me take you sort of extraterritorial here and ask you about the global economy, right? With China and then Europe and Brazil. I mean, you know, a lot of places that used to be going gangbusters aren't. We now, once again, are sort of left to carry the burden. And I wonder if we're able to do that given our stuckness.
Our stuckness is a problem, and it's a very different global economy than it was in the 1990s when maybe the U.S. was in a position to do that. U.S. growth is obviously not good, but it's far from disastrous. In the other big developed economies in Europe and in Japan, it's less good. You give it a little frowny face, but it's not disastrous there either.
I don't use emoticons, man.
And then the rest of the world is just awfully messy. China is a huge black box. We have no idea what's really going on in there, and the concerns about China are reverberating everywhere else. And so until we make sense of that, we won't really know how we're going to come through through the rest of the year.
Well, I'll tell you what, then. I'm going to throw you two the same question I gave to Catherine and Cardiff last week, and largely they poo-pooed me, but I'm curious to see what you two have to say. Are we, Lee, do you think, looking for a recession here and a recovery and an economic boom that's now very long in the tooth?
I don't think so. I think that there's a chance. I think the chances are lower than having a recession. I mean, you know, like Sudeep said, our economy is growing and it's not, you know, 4 or 5%. We haven't seen that in a while, but it's okay. I mean, you know, the past couple weeks have not been great. And if you look at things like inventories and manufacturing and durable goods, it's not going in the right direction, but I don't think we're at the R word.
I will say you were not enthusiastic in that rejection of my thesis.
I know.
Sudeep,
but there's a very big difference between
those
things
totally
and a recession.
Right. That is totally true and an important fact. Sudeep, last word to you. You have 19 seconds.
We can muddle through this. It's entirely possible we can get through this year and maybe even next year with slow growth and just pulling us along bit by bit. But we are one shock away from a recession, and it's not going to take a lot. That is what the most terrifying factor is, and we have not set up the infrastructure, the policy to respond to something like that, and won't really know how to deal with it until long after it has arrived. That's the problem that we're facing.
All right, we got to go. Sudeep Reddy at the Wall Street Journal, Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, have a nice weekend. Wall Street Today, I will tell you what, one thing you did not want to be on this Friday was a tech stock. They had a rough go of it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've been back and forth between El Paso, Texas, and Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, these past couple of days for our election year series, My Economy. We were talking, first of all, on Wednesday about what it's like to run a small business in the borderland when the dollar and the exchange rate is a big problem.
Our sales have decreased, I'd say, a good 35% since the peso devaluated this year. And we've cut our workforce right now, I'd say, about 50%.
Also, yesterday, about what somebody's life and personal economy is like when they have to live between two countries.
I went to visit my wife. She lives at Juarez.
Your wife lives in Juarez? You live here?
Yeah, she was deported, so we're waiting for the lawyer to get papers right now and everything to bring her back.
Today, a story about the future, about the economic aspirations of young people in the borderland.
the life and the kind of job that I want.
Prosperity.
Providing for your children.
My head above water.
My economy.
My economy.
My economy.
Just off the Bridge of the Americas, on this side of the border, is Bowie High School, one of the oldest high schools in El Paso.
This is the Rio Grande right out here, right? I mean, that's like Juarez.
Yes.
A block and a half that way.
Yeah.
That's Taryn Medina. She's a senior. And unlike a lot of the kids who go to Bowie, she was born, raised, and lives in El Paso.
How much of a factor in your life is the fact that this is a border town, that people go back and forth all the time?
Well, I've lived here all my life, so it's just normal. Everyone just comes back and forth, and it's not anything new to us.
A good number of her classmates start their days on the other side of the border. They wake up in Juarez and then commute over the bridge and the Rio Grande to El Paso. Some of them are American citizens. Others are Mexicans with student visas. But that Mexico to America walk to school is so common that there are special pedestrian lanes just for students at the bridges.
A lot of my friends that I have class with, they come to school because it's either they come to school, they get an education, or they can't provide for their family. So this is their only opportunity to provide, because a lot of our families here, they live in poverty, and if they can't get out of the cycle of poverty, then they're just going to go back into it and they won't be able to provide.
A lot of them come for economic reasons. Others, because it's just safer. The violence in Juarez was so bad a couple of years ago that parents started sending their kids to school in the States.
Hi, I'm Cynthia Gomez. I'm a current senior here at Bowie High School.
Cynthia came to Bowie 2 years ago. She's an American citizen, but her parents live in Juarez, so she is back and forth across that border all the time, living with her aunt in El Paso during the week, her parents in Juarez over the weekend.
My mother works in Mexico, in Juarez. Mm-hmm. Now we're struggling a little bit because of the increment of the dollar value, because
the exchange rate.
Yes, yeah. It has increased a lot. So we are always moving back and forth. My father had his business in Juarez. It was closed a few years ago because of the inconvenience of the violence that was in there. So yes, it has been like 4 years that he doesn't have his job. So. But it is getting better, so we need to move on.
Kids like Cynthia are constantly moving between two cultures and two languages, two countries even. Some of them, when they go to school, are all alone in a different country. A lot of their parents don't have passports, so they can't get here. 2 years ago, before she came to Bowie, Cynthia didn't speak any English. And now she's looking at the University of Texas, Austin, and maybe MIT.
I'm okay with UT Austin, actually.
Yeah. MIT or UT Austin, take your pick.
Her days consist of school pretty much all day. She gets to campus around 7 in the morning. Calculus is first period.
And after lunch, I need to cover all my English classes. I'm actually taking English 2, 3, and 4 together.
You're taking English 2, 3, and 4 together?
Yes. And then usually we stay for robotics club. And sometimes we have haiku competitions.
Haiku competitions?
Haiku, yes.
Wow.
And then we go home late.
That means she's often not done till 5 in the afternoon, later, sometimes.
How long does it actually take to get back and forth over the border? I was talking to people this morning who say it takes 2 hours.
It depends. If you have a car, it can go 15 minutes to 3 hours. It's because it's too easy to come from Juarez to here to buy things. It's like going to other side of the city. It's not like crossing to other country.
The border is a real economic barrier, and it matters what side of it you're on. The unemployment rate in El Paso is a really good 4.8%, but still, a quarter of the people there live below the poverty line, which for kids like Taryn Medina creates a different kind of ambition. She's thinking Ivy League.
We applied to Stanford, we applied to Michigan, Boston, all those big places. So if we do get financial aid and we have the opportunity to go out there, it would be such a great thing to do. To accomplish and bring it back to our community and just really help our community out.
If you get into Harvard and Stanford, it's going to be pretty different than El Paso.
Well, if you want to succeed and if you want to have, a life, you have to go for it.
We're going to check back with Taryn and Cynthia Gomez later on this spring when college acceptances come in. We'll let you know where they wind up because, honestly, I'm kind of curious. In the meanwhile, go to our website, meet Taryn and Cynthia, and hear the rest of the stories in our series, My Economy, while you're there. It's all online at marketplace.org.
Coming up,
Irving Kot is unknown to most people, but to securities regulators all over the world, he's notorious.
Remember that when you watch the coin toss Sunday in the Super Bowl, all right? But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so volatility again, huh? The Dow Industrial's off 211 points, 1.3%, closed at 16,204. The NASDAQ down 146 points, 3.25%, finished at 4,363. The S&P 500 down 35 points, 1.8%, ended things at 1,880. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow off 1.6%, the NASDAQ down 5.4%. The S&P 500 off 0.3%. Online networking service LinkedIn plunged 43.6% after providing a weak forecast for 2016. Other tech stocks suffered as well. Facebook down 5.8%. Amazon down 6.3%. Bond prices rose just a touch. The yield on the 10-year T-note remained at 1.84%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Here's a couple of big company names. You tell me what they've got in common, all right? Ready, go. Coca-Cola, IBM, Verizon, and American Express. How about that? The people keeping the books at all four of those companies and a whole bunch more actually share a deep concern over how much they're paying every year for healthcare. So some of the most recognizable names in corporate America have formed what they are calling the Health Transformation Alliance. The idea is to share the data about what they're paying for their employees' health care and then what results they're seeing employee health-wise. And so the logic goes, crack the healthcare black box that makes that kind of cost-benefit information really hard to come by. It's not going to be easy, but Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein at the Health Desk at WHYY reports there's at least one reason to think those companies are on the right track.
For years, CEOs have talked big, how they want to control health spending, find more value, blah, blah, blah. Well, now 20 companies are ready to get dirty in data, says Tevi Troy, one of the architects of the group.
Nobody has brought together these many companies of this magnitude with a real willingness to sit down together, bring together their collective data, and get better answers from healthcare.
The companies in this alliance spend more than $14 billion a year on healthcare for 4 million people. They want to crunch all that data on price and outcomes, hoping to find good deals. Yale economist Zach Cooper, who's pawed through troves of data, warns it's ugly under the hood.
The variation of price is just insane. So in the same cities, MRIs vary by a factor of 10. They're going to find that there's no relationship between price and quality.
In theory, this new initiative turns up the heat, especially on hospitals, to be more transparent about how well they do what they do and how much it all costs.
Symbolically, this is a really important move.
Harvard's Dr. Ashish Jha says he's not convinced the alliance in particular is any kind of game changer, but hospitals tend to make their margins off of the privately insured. That gives business a loud voice.
The people who write the checks tend to have really a lot of influence on what happens in a marketplace. And employers have just not been as engaged as they need to.
Remember, 170 million Americans get their health care through work. And if companies start taking the purchase of health care as serious as they take their own business, Jha says the potential for transformation is there. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Not only is the Zika virus putting a dent in Carnival festivities down in Brazil this year, the big celebrations start today, by the way, but a lot of cities have cut back or canceled their festivities outright because the Brazilian economy is in such a sorry state they can't afford to throw the parties. Ashley Milne-Tide has that story.
The whole point of Carnival is to be lavish. It's not a time for holding back. At least it hasn't been. Fernanda Cury works in advertising production in Sao Paulo. She says a nearby city, Campinas, can't fund the usual parade put on by local samba schools. We spoke on Skype.
The mayor is saying that instead of doing the parade, they're buying medicine and an ambulance and, you know, they're justifying why are they not doing carnivals because they need to buy what's really essential. So that's really sad.
Paulo Sotero directs the Brazil Institute at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. He says Brazilians are generally an optimistic bunch, but these days morale is low. It's not just the lousy economy. The Zika virus is spreading, and there's an ongoing government corruption scandal.
This is no time for carnival, you know, where Brazil is facing a very serious crisis.
He says the country should do less partying.
More thinking about the future of the nation, because the way we respond to this crisis will very much shape the future.
Unemployment stands at 10% right now, and he says it could go up. But no matter how bad things are, Fernanda Cury says most people will party on. She says this is the one time of year Brazilians forget their worries.
People would just go out there and scream happiness. So this is something that's a phenomenal. It's just amazing what happens here. And it's going to happen again.
I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Assuming the laws of physics cooperate, the Super Bowl is going to start on Sunday with the flip of a coin. I raise the possibility of doubt because the referee for the Super Bowl and the guy thus doing the toss, Cleet Blakeman is his name, is the same guy who managed to toss the coin and not have it flip at the start of overtime in the Packers-Cardinals game a couple of weeks ago. But I digress because what we're talking about next is not the toss but the coin itself. This being the NFL, it's not just any coin, of course, and therein lies the tale. Caleb Hannon wrote about it for Bloomberg Businessweek in a piece called The Super Bowl Coin Toss Has a Dark Secret. Caleb, it's good to have you on.
Thanks.
Tell me, first of all, about this company that makes these coins. It's a tiny company with a piece of the biggest event in American sports, as you say.
It is. So the company's name is the Highland Mint. And they have a factory in Melbourne, Florida. It is exactly what you're picturing. There are palm trees all over the place. It's right next to a causeway. It's very beautiful. And they've been around for over 25 years, and they produce the Super Bowl flip coin, and they have for over two decades.
It's not your average coin. I mean, this thing is like the pictures show it to be huge. And this year it's got what does it have? It's got the Panthers on one part of the 50 and then the Broncos on the other, right?
Yeah, they don't have anything really to do with the design. The NFL basically tells them what to put on there. And they put it on there. And the NFL has come up with that design months in advance, as lots of things are involving the most popular sports league in America. They're very particular.
It didn't used to be this way. I mean, it's not quite like in Super Bowl I, the ref took a quarter out the midfield and flipped it, but it was a much more low-key affair when it started, the coin toss.
It didn't really become a formal, commercialized part of what is one of the biggest commercial events of the year until 1993 or 94, when the NFL basically asked another company that Highland Mint was working with to produce an official coin. I believe it was the 50th anniversary of the league, not the Super Bowl itself.
Which is, of course, this year. They also, by the way, Highland Mint does, you can buy a copy of this coin for $99, right?
Yeah. As soon as they know the participants, they start selling the coin. So they're ready to go. And if you want to purchase one, you can.
Let me ask you about the title of the piece. The Super Bowl coin toss has a dark secret. What's the dark secret? How bad can it be?
Highland Mint was purchased in 1993 using shares of another company, which was secretly run by a man named Irving Kott. Irving Kott is unknown to most people, but to securities regulators all over the world, he's notorious. Basically, the short version of it is, here's a man who spent 50 years running boiler rooms, selling worthless stock to people who lost a lot of money, who twice had assassination attempts on his life by the Canadian mob. And this is the company that was used to purchase the company that now makes the coin.
And the quote of the piece in this thing about Irving Kott is that, and it's an FBI guy, it says, without Irving Kott, the Wolf of Wall Street never gets made. So Jordan Belfort and that whole movie with Leo and that whole deal, I mean, this company goes sort of to the roots of that.
Yeah, one of the things that Irvin Kott did after he helped his son purchase the Highland Mint was he was secretly running a brokerage in L.A. called J.B. Oxford. And Jordan Belfort, who wasn't a known name then, had just lost the company that was processing his trades. According to this FBI agent, who eventually served a 48-count indictment against Irvin Kott, Kott was Belfort's savior. Without him, he never would have been able to introduce those toxic IPOs that made him famous. And according to that agent, without him, there would be no memoir, there would be no movie.
Caleb Hannon, his piece on the crazy backstory to the company that makes those NFL coins, is in Bloomberg Business Week. It's called The Super Bowl Coin Toss Has a Dark Secret. Caleb, thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Kyle.
This final note on the way out today, Super Bowl edition. The nod for this one goes to Jane Wells at CNBC. She got two players from the Carolina Panthers, long snapper J.J. Jansen and punter Brad Nortman, in front of her camera, and she put them through their economic paces.
Are the markets up or down this year?
Down, big time down, about 10%, 8 to 10%.
How much is a barrel of oil?
Right around 30, maybe a little bit under right now.
What's more valuable at the moment, Google or Apple?
I think Google just overtook Apple, maybe within the last day or two.
I think, though, today, I think Apple went above Google. Alphabet.
It's close.
Pretty good, right? He knew the whole Alphabet thing, too. Me, though, I'm still going with the Broncos to win. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 211 points, 1.3% today. The NASDAQ off 3.25%, 146 points. Bad, bad day for tech stocks. The S&P 500 down 35 points, 1.8% there as well. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a good weekend, everybody. We'll see you here on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.